From sprains to fractures, get expert care quickly at the University of Kansas Health System. Walk-in orthopedic care is open weekdays, 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 to 2, at I-435 and Null. Learn more at kansashealthsystem.com/orthopedics.
We'll get back to talking about Eric Bieniemy a little bit later, but the tweet I was going to read from Tom Pelissero from NFL Network. Chiefs offensive coordinator Eric Bieniemy's contract is expiring per sources. So after getting passed over for head coaching opportunities again, Bieniemy could either return to Kansas City or be a hot free agent offensive coordinator target elsewhere. And the question is, if he truly is, what are the things that's holding him back? He's not being given credit for anything that's happening in Kansas City. Then at what point do you feel like, okay, I need to go somewhere else and have success on my own, and maybe that will get other NFL teams to open their eyes and give me the credit I deserve? It sucks that he would even have to consider doing that, but is that a possibility?
I think so.
We'll talk more about it at 7:30. But
it just seems like the things that you just listed off, outside of maybe being a bad interviewer, the other things that you listed off, those are all things that have not held other coaches back. You know?
Well, we don't know how other coaches interview, right, like you said.
Yeah.
But, again, that was a tweet from Benjamin Albright. We'll talk more about that at 7:30. Let's get back into the Kansas game against Texas last night. And to talk about that with us, we have Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you? And thanks for introducing me with the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
But the idea that he has to move in order to get hired, who gets credit for the offense with the 49ers? Didn't Shanahan basically invent the whole genre?
Yep.
I mean, isn't that what they say? So,
yep.
So like the guy who was in the box for him just got a head coaching job. I don't see how that could be an issue for anybody, especially in that environment.
Well, after interviewing, I think 14 or 15 times now, it's got to be something, and so that's why we're left to try to figure out what the hell it is. You know what I mean?
I don't think it's that big a mystery at this point.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I think the goings on in the coach carousel at the NFL level have painted a pretty clear picture for all of us.
Mike DeCourcy is our guest. Before we move on from that, any other comments about that?
No, I think that captures it, right?
Yep.
I mean, the guy's not getting what he's earned, and neither, there are lots of coaches who can say the same. Some of them who had head jobs and now no longer do. Think about how much angst it took for Chicago to move on from Matt Nagy, and how quickly Miami was ready to part with Brian Flores after he had one of the really terrific second halves in NFL history, came back from nowhere to the verge of the playoffs and gone. So I just don't think that I think that they're making it obvious what their approach is generally.
Mike DeCourcy is our guest. All right, Mike, last night, very entertaining game between Texas and Kansas down in Austin, and it looked like Kansas was going to come away with another big victory and take a huge step towards winning the Big 12 conference. But, man, I watching that game, I did not anticipate Texas coming back and winning at the end and basically going on a 7-0 run in the final minute of the game to win 79-76. So I'd just like to get your reaction there to the final minute, that 7-0 run that gave Texas the victory.
Yeah, honestly, up until the final minute, I thought there were some really positive developments, including David McCormick's really nice post basket. I don't remember the time, and I don't have the play-by-play in front of me, but it was a key moment late in the game when they were trying to establish control of the game. And, I mean, he had 16 points and 7 rebounds and was 6 of 10 from the field and, maybe more important than anything, played 30 minutes. And I thought, based on that it was a really positive experience for the Jayhawks, even though they lost the game. for him to go out and play against the front line with a lot of big bodies. I mean, maybe there's no Kofi Coburn on Texas's roster, but that's a lot of big bodies, a lot of dynamic guys in the front court, and he stood up to all of that. And, you know, in a lot of ways, if that holds, and I think that's at least I think that's at least his second good game in a row. And, you know, that there aren't many times in his career, actually third. He played pretty well in the Baylor game on the road, and then he played really well in the Iowa State game, too. I mean, third good game in a row, fifth in the last six. Obviously, he was not good against Kentucky, but I'm not sure who else was that day. So, you know, I think that's I think that in itself is maybe the biggest takeaway from last night, other than the impact on the Big 12 race and seedings and such, is that if he continues to play like this, they're a threat. I mean, before they were somebody that was waiting, like waiting to be an upset pick, waiting to be an upset victim at some point in the NCAA tournament. And if he continues this, I mean, this is probably the longest stretch of quality basketball he has had against major conference competition in his career. And so I thought that was really big. Jalen Wilson, again, played really well. And I think the one thing that you saw in this game is, and you couple this to an extent with the Duke game, I don't know if you guys got a chance to watch that beforehand, but you know the point guard position is still essential, and gaining command of that position is essential. And I did not think DeJuan Harris played a poor game. I thought he played very well. But again, like in that last moment when Texas said basically, okay, you know, we're taking everybody else away. You have to beat us. And he turned the ball over without much encouragement. That can happen. That's the difference at this level. And, you know, Texas may or may not be the level of team you play when you get fairly deep into the NCAA tournament. But you add on the home crowd, and that's the level of challenge you'll face. And you have to be able to stand up to that. And again, you don't have to necessarily, if he goes down that lane, you know, it may be a lob to David on the opposite side of the rim. It may just be you get the ball up on the rim and hope that the action that you drew, creates an opportunity, an offensive rebound. The reality was there wasn't much reaction. Again, they just said, you're going to have to do it because no one came. It was just him and his guy, and he lost the ball. And I'm not trying to hang this on him. I'm just saying that's the position that a lot of programs at the high level have trouble with. And Kansas is one. They are not, you know, they are not flush at that position. He's a good, solid player, but in that circumstance, the ball has got to get on the rim. It can't just go flying off your hand without anybody really having much to do with it. And so that's something that, as KU continues to develop itself, I think that's something that needs to be improved. You know, the other element is that the fact that they had a rough last minute or two may have something to do with the fact that they didn't sub much. I mean, Jalen Wilson 32, Ochai 38, Dewan 38, Christian 33, David 30. I realize it's a tough environment. You got a lot of guys, though, and so the fact that they didn't sub much, I think, probably was to Texas's advantage. There was a little bit more freshness to them in the final 2 minutes than there was to the Jayhawks. And hey, there's a lot of KU's got a lot of guys. There's a lot of usable players, and I think they're still trying to work out how to use all of them in a rotation that. That sort of follows a pattern. If it's not a pattern, then a concept where you know this, we're going to probably use this guy then, this guy for this circumstance, this guy for that circumstance. I think they're still working that out. And it, you know, as a result, you had all your starters basically go the full distance, and I don't think it helped.
All right, Mike, you're touching on some things. As I was scrolling Twitter last night, that are hot button issues with some of the KU fans. And I'm trying to figure out this new Twitter algorithm because all of a sudden I'm getting tweets from people who I don't follow, and I'm trying to figure out how to manage that because I'm getting a lot of just unhinged vitriol from KU fans that that's not what I'm looking for when I go on Twitter after a game. I'm hoping to get some quotes from Bill Self and some stats on the game, things like that from people I actually follow. But because I've seen all that, I know that you mentioned DeJuan Harris. Boy, he's a lightning rod right now. Remy Martin is out with an injury. But a lot of these KU fans, they feel like it's got to be all the things you just said about how DeJuan Harris, didn't get it done at the last minute of the game. That's why Remy Martin's got to be out there, and that's why Bill Self has this blind spot. He loves DeJuan Harris too much. And they're also outraged that the last play was drawn up for McCormick. Because basically, Ramey was doing such an incredible job on Abaji that I think Self decided, we got a better chance of getting a decent look with McCormick. They're outraged about that as well, and about the fact that Harris is playing so many minutes. They want Yesufu to play more instead of him. So I guess I'll give the floor to you on those issues.
Well, I think, first of all, my point was just that in that moment, he's got to do better. He had 8 points and six assists. Turned the ball over once prior to that. So, he's gone 37 and a half minutes with one turnover against a defense that has 6'4", 6'4", 6'5", in the backcourt, all of them dynamic. He's fine. It just was a bad moment. And I'm just stressing that he's got to stand up to that moment, whether he makes the bucket or not, or whether he, finds David. But look, okay, draw up a play for Ochai. That's great. Then you're abandoning it anyway because they weren't letting him have the ball. I mean, that wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You saw it. He flashes to the ball, and was it Ramey that was on him?
Yep. The whole game, by the way, 39 minutes of chasing him around, pretty much.
I mean, he was so close to him, that he was practically wearing the same uniform. I mean, you were not getting him the ball, so it was smart to draw the play up for David in that circumstance because you knew they weren't going to let him have it. And I was sitting there watching it saying they're not going to let him have it. Everybody could see that. So you had to have an alternative. Should they have run it for Christian? Well, if you're doing that, you're probably getting a jump shot. And I think Christian is wonderful. I think he's a pro. I'm not alone in that. As a three-point shooter, he's a 32.5% shooter. I'd rather have David shooting 60% or so from the inside than a 32.5% shot at a game winner. So no, I think they ran the right play. I just don't think it was completed. Although, like I said, I was critical of how he handled that moment. He's having a really good year, and I can tell you right now that if Remy Martin were playing there, especially with all the interruptions and really not much of a chance to try to get away from what his natural game is, which is to take on the world, I don't think, I think if he came back tomorrow, I think he can help you in certain circumstances? Yes, if you're really struggling against the defense and you can't get anything out of your offense and you need to say, okay, Remy, you can do this on your own, go ahead. This is the situation for you to do what you do. I'm totally fine with that. He's as good as there is in college basketball at getting his own shot. But that's it. I mean, it's a one-hit wonder. And I don't know that that's what they need with the nature of the players that they have. They have to run their actions to get good offense. Unless it's Ochai creating something, if they don't do that, then David becomes less productive, then Christian becomes less productive, Jalen Wilson becomes less productive, because none of those guys is going out and getting his own. It's only Ochai and Remy, and Ochai wouldn't have the ball. So I don't think that that's the solution. And I don't think, as I said before, the first thing I said was all positive. I don't think last night is anything to get exercised about. I thought there were really good moments at the end of that game that said a lot about what Kansas is capable of. You lost a game on the road to a good team. That's what happens in college basketball.
It's No Hangovers May with Green Light Dispensary. Enjoy their flower specials all month long by visiting one of their four KC area locations. Or check out their AI bud tenders at greenlightdispensary.com. That's greenlightdispensary.com.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. The way I watch the game, you know, Texas banks in a three-pointer. A guy who had been terrible shooting threes most of the game.
He laughed at that shot.
Yeah.
See the reaction?
Yeah. Christian Brown, who's usually a great free throw shooter, missed two big free throws. And, you know, Ochai has a chance to throw a lob to McCormick. It hits the rim. Otherwise, that's a dunk. I think if any of those plays go the other way, KU probably wins. I'm with you on that. The thing that I thought was interesting was, so after the game, Bill Self wasn't talking about the offensive possession as much as he was. He was mad that the game-winning shot by Texas was a wide-open shot by the guy that was the player of the game that had already had a huge day. And he said, we got to get better defensively. While all of the fans are, not all, a big vocal percentage of fans are mad about this point guard situation on offense, I look at Ken Palm's rankings. He's got KU as the third best offense in the country behind Purdue and Gonzaga.
Yes.
He's got him as the 36th best defense, which isn't terrible, but usually it seems like teams that go win the title are top 10 in both. Can KU get better enough defensively? I mean, and how much of a priority does that need to be for them?
Yeah, I seem to recall the last time I had this conversation. I think it was with you guys. It may not. I'm pretty sure it was because I don't talk, you know, on the radio to others out that way. And they were much higher than this 2-3 weeks ago. Maybe Fran and I were talking about it because we talk all the time. But I seem to recall that they were much deeper than this, and that they've already made improvements just to get to 36.
Yeah.
And I can say that it doesn't necessarily need to be top 10. It's usually top 20. Top 20 brings in just about every champion that we've had since Ken Palm started doing these numbers, except for Connecticut in 2014. I think their offense was significantly lower. But one of the other things that, you know, one of the things that 2015 taught me when Duke won it was that you could look at Duke's numbers in early February and you'd say, well, there's no way they can win the title, because they're like 75th in defense. And then you watched as Coach K made some adjustments. He made Justice Winslow a four-man and power forward instead of a small forward, and they got smaller and quicker and more dynamic, and all of a sudden their defense got a lot better. And by the time they won it, they were top 12, top 10, something like that. And I'm talking about literally coming from 75 in early February, and even when the tournament began, they were like 39, and they just kept improving and improving as they went through the tournament. And by the time they got to it, the number was there. So it you have to have the capacity to improve. Now, what does Kansas need to do better? Well, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that they've got one of the great defensive coaches in college basketball, certainly in current college basketball, and probably in college basketball history. Their defense is going to get better. He's continued to improve it all the way to here, and it'll continue to get better. And again, that's probably a place where DeJuan Harris can become a more impactful player. You know, he's not super physical. He's not super dynamic, but he's got to find a way to be more effective against the ball than he is now. And I think that comes from understanding the game, which he does at a really high level, but he's got to be able to use that intelligence to cut off angles, to make sure that he understands where the next pass is going so that he can bother it, those kinds of things. And I think he can do that. And then, I think from the other standpoint, I think David being able to play 30 minutes, maybe you don't want to do that all the time, but at least, you know, having him out there 30 minutes last night said that you were happy with his performance. You're talking about a guy who's 6'10", 6'11", 260, whatever the number is, great physicality, but only averages 20 minutes a game on the season. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, but those reasons haven't been apparent over the last 5-6 games. He's earning more minutes. That helps with defensive rebounding, which helps your defense. It helps it improve. The physicality and the size he presents help with your defense. So I think the number one thing, honestly, the number one thing I'm taking away from last night is David McCormack went in against a terrific deep front line and didn't flinch for 30 minutes. and made one of the game's biggest buckets. Didn't end up mattering, but it one of the game's biggest buckets with all that weight on his shoulders. I don't know that I would have seen that from him against a team like this 2 months ago. And so that's how your defense improves. A little bit of improvement from DeJuan and the continued presence of David and Coach Self's game planning, and it will continue to escalate, and this team will be more effective in early March than it is now.
Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News is our guest. Mike, Kansas State has won back-to-back games, and they host number 10 Baylor on Wednesday night at Brambridge Coliseum. And so I'm curious, now that Kansas State has put together a couple of wins and they have this big opportunity game against Baylor, how far off are they from being back on the bubble?
You know, not far. And there's a couple of games that you say, oh, if only this one had gone the other way, that, you know, they let the KU game get away at the end. That was a big one. You know, the West Virginia game on the road, the TCU game at home, any one of those. They were all right there in those games, and they got away from them. But they paid back TCU and got the road win on Saturday. Nigel Pack, another great game for him. The almost the entire starting five in double figures, which, you know, says a lot about what they are, you know, the growth of that team and how much more consistent they are offensively than they were early in the year. You know, I think I'm doing my bracket now, and they are right there for a spot, you know, on the bubble, you know, on the outside, obviously. But if they beat Baylor, they would probably be in the first group out, at least. And my goodness, if you look at this, like when I'm doing, here's how difficult it is this year to bracket, okay? When I do the bracket, I always get to a seed line where it's like, there aren't enough of those. There aren't enough of eights. There aren't enough 11s or whatever it is. I get to the six line now, and I'm like, there aren't four sixes. I mean, that's how grim it is. So how do you fight your way into a field this grim, so to speak, is just win. I mean, if K-State wins, let me look at it. If they win down the stretch, and they've got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 games left. And out of those seven, they 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, probably 5-ish of those are quad ones. That's, you know, they have a chance if they could go 3-2 in those and get at least one of the non-quad ones, because they, you know, the non-quad ones in this league are Oklahoma at home and WVU at home. I mean, that's not easy. But if you could go, you know, if you could go 4-3 down the stretch, something like that, you're in the picture. You'd obviously have to win some at least one in KC, but you're in the picture. And because, like I said, I mean, the rest of it is really not attractive from the sixth line on down. And the teams that are on those lines aren't winning. I mean, when I got to the sixth line that last night, I mean, LSU has lost like 6 out of their last 7 games or something like that. Mm. And I can't find anybody to replace them on that line because no one else wants to win a game.
Mike DeCourcy is our guest. Mike, we'll wrap up, and I'll just briefly touch on Mizzou. They won a road game against Texas A&M over the weekend. And look, since they were blown out at Arkansas several games ago, they've been competitive in all of these games. They only won one at Mississippi, but they've led for most of the game several times, but they've just found different ways to lose in the end, in the final minute or so. And they finally turned that around at Texas A&M. Tonight, they play at Vanderbilt, and then they'll play Mississippi. Then they've got a couple of games against Mississippi State, a rematch against Arkansas. And so they've at least got some winnable games because they have been playing more competitive. But I'll be honest with you, and this shouldn't surprise anyone, a lot of the fan base is tuned out. They had seen enough, and no one, you know, people aren't going to the games, which is very difficult for a coach that's trying to convince the athletic department that he's the right guy to keep the job. The interest just isn't there. And if you don't have butts and seats, that's a big problem. So I'm just curious, what should Missouri fans take away from the team being more competitive, the team clearly improving, getting a road win, but it just feels like it could be too little too late?
Well, you know, here's what the way they're performing and their performances tell you is, like, they've got a good enough coach. They're because the players who are there are continuing to play for him. They're continuing to compete. They're continuing to win games. That game was huge for Texas A&M. And Texas A&M is trying to get in and had been trending the wrong way, and they're looking like, okay, here comes Mizzou, and we're going to get well. And that team hasn't won. They've lost four games in a row, six out of their last seven. This is our game to get well, and it wasn't, because Mizzou hasn't surrendered. The question at this point is, can you get enough good players to come there to win games? Because it's not a question of whether when you're looking at a coach, I think the number one thing you have to evaluate is, are his guys still playing hard for him? That's the first thing you want to see. And in this circumstance, the answer is yes. I mean, it's resoundingly yes, based on the close results of some of those games. Florida, again, another team is trying to stay alive. A&M that, like I said, really needed that win. Even Auburn. I mean, my goodness, Auburn's the number one team in the country, and you almost beat them. So they're continuing to compete. The question then is, can you get enough good players? I don't really understand why he recruited so well at Tennessee and recruited so well early here and recruited so well at Cal, and why he's hit this dry spell. I don't understand that. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But if I had a reason to believe that enough good players were going to get there, I wouldn't necessarily believe that you needed a new coach. That's the problem is that this coach in this circumstance, in this time frame, didn't get enough good players to win in the SEC. And so it's up to Mizzou to decide whether or not the need to get more good players in there warrants a coaching change. I would want to hear from Konzo on how he decided, or how he reached the point where this is the guys we can get. These are the best guys. Or did he misevaluate? Or did he just whiff? All those kinds of things play into this. But I wouldn't make, you know, if they were getting blown out now, it's like, it's not a hard call. It's easy call. They're the bottom, near the bottom of their league, and they're getting blown out. That's an easy call. But that's not what's happening. They're continuing to compete. And I do think that they need to find out why they got into the circumstance that they have the roster that they do.
That's right. I mean, nine new players. He rebuilt the roster this season, and to this point it hasn't worked out, but there's still plenty of games left.
Or is the question that this group just needs another year? That can be the answer, because it wouldn't be the first time. That's one of the oldest stories in college sports, is that this team just needs more time, and they'll be really good next year. I don't know that I can evaluate that. In watching them play, I haven't necessarily seen that, but I haven't watched them closely enough to evaluate that. I wasn't in practice this year, COVID and all the rest of this nonsense. So I didn't see them work out and have an idea of what they were capable of. I've seen them play a few times, but not sure that I was evaluating whether or not they could eventually be good enough to win a fair share of SEC games. But I right now, the roster in its current state isn't good enough to win SEC games on the regular. But can it develop? I'd want to hear from him on all of that. I don't think the easiest thing in college sports to do is change coaches. It's the easiest thing to do. It's very often the wrong answer. I know that this guy has won games, has won a lot of games. And the question is, can he put together a roster that can compete at the highest level of the SEC, and can he win big games? That's something that he has not done regularly.
That's right.
Made the Sweet 16 in what that was, 14 or 15 at Tennessee, and hasn't been deep since.
That's the only season in his career that he's won an NCAA tournament game.
Right. And you know, I mean, last year's team, the way that team declined late, added to this, I can understand why there's frustration.
Right.
But I'd still want to have an idea. I'd want to have a plan. And I'd want to know if you move on, because you're not moving on from somebody who can't coach. There's no question. If you were to move on, I should say, if you were to move on, you're not moving on from somebody who doesn't have ability. That's happened many times, and that's, you know, and you need to move on from somebody who doesn't have ability. The question is, if you make a plan to move on, if you decide to move on, where are you moving? Like, what direction are you going? You need to have a good plan for that instead of just, well, we know we need to do this, and then we'll figure it out when we get there. Because very often, that's how you wind up with somebody who can't win games.
Right. You have to ask yourself, how high is the ceiling? And it just doesn't seem it's very high with Konzo, as history would suggest. But, you know, let's see how they finish the season. And you're right, those discussions must happen immediately in the off season. Mike, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it. We will talk to you next week.
All right, guys, thanks.
That's Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News. Always good to hear from Mike talking college basketball. We'll be right back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.